Hello, my friends. This is Dr. Beter. Today is January 20, 1981, and this is my audio letter number 61. It's been about a month and a half now since I recorded audio letter 60 at the end of November. Beginning with this issue, number 61, I plan to record my audio letter on a slightly more flexible schedule. I still plan to record a message roughly once a month, but from now on, I want to tie my schedule more to events and less to the calendar. After all, the audio letter is recording history in the making. Sometimes the end of the month arrives just as a major story is breaking, either in public or behind closed doors. From now on, when that happens, I may well delay for a few days to give you a more complete story. On other occasions, it may work the other way, speeding up my audio letter schedule. All of this will have no effect on your subscription. You will receive all the issues you paid for, no matter when they are released. So I hope that with a more flexible schedule, I will be able to serve you better than ever before. Because, my friends, events are building toward a climax. Since I spoke with you last, the world was shocked, saddened, and angered by a seemingly senseless murder in New York City. The victim was the former Beatle and rock star John Lennon. Lennon was fond of saying that a rock star can say things without being killed for it. And after 5 years out of the public eye, Lennon was going back to work, not because he needed the money, but because he had things to say. But the things he had to say this time, my friends, would have caused trouble for those who are maneuvering us into nuclear war. And so a former fan of his was turned into a psychologically programmed assassin. This was done using the techniques I made public over 5 years ago in Audio Letter 5. And on the eve of his return to public life, John Lennon was silenced. My friends, lawless forces are destroying our way of life. They have spawned a soaring crime rate about which many of you have written to me asking questions. If you want to understand how these lawless forces affect you personally, there is a new book I would like to recommend to you. The author is a highly respected business consultant, Mr. Fred Mueller, M-U-L-L-E-R. His book is titled America's Coming Nightmare Inflation, Economic Collapse, and Crime Revolution. The price is $10 postpaid, and you can order it directly from Fred Mueller, Post Office Box 11909, Columbia, South Carolina 29211. If we sit idly by and let it happen, these forces of lawlessness will sweep away everything that is dear to us. They are destroying our money and our economy, robbing us of our hard-won assets. They are making many fear for their own lives when they walk the streets. They are perverting our laws and corrupting our lawmakers, and they are working night and day to betray us into the insanity of nuclear war. But there is something we can do. Last July 1980, I began answering your questions about what you can do. And because so many of you have responded with action, I will continue to tell you more. We are making progress, and if we do not lose heart, I am convinced that we are going to win. My three special topics for this audio letter are Topic number 1, the legal sabotage of the Reagan transition. Topic number 2, the forfeited opportunity of Senator William Proxmire. And Topic number 3, the golden swindle of the Federal Reserve Banks. Topic number 1. 2 months ago, America was buzzing over the great surprise landslide in the name of Ronald Reagan. There were all kinds of upbeat promises to hit the ground running, quote unquote. But the transition to a new administration has actually done just the opposite. First, the early choices for several cabinet positions fell apart. People who had appeared interested suddenly just backed out. Meanwhile, the job of filling lower echelon positions became even worse. Instead of hitting the ground running, the transition team was wading through a swamp. Weeks ago, the transition team exhausted its government money and had to start asking their corporate friends for donations to stay in business. Puzzled reporters and columnists have been scratching their heads over it all. Veteran Washington watchers can tell something is wrong. They can sniff it in the air. And for public consumption, the so-called Reagan team has tried to blame it all on the Ethics in Government Act of 1978. But, my friends, that is not the real problem. Something much more far-reaching is involved. The fact is that the new administration has been virtually locked out by the Bolsheviks and bureaucratic power here. The symptoms of this unprecedented situation are growing on all sides. For example, a few days ago on January 12, the New York Times carried an article with a headline, "Campaign Aides for Reagan Fear They Are Left Out." The article said, quote, "The Reagan transition aides now expect to have only about 50 upper-level officials chosen by the time Mr. Reagan is sworn in on January 20," unquote. And this is in connection with, quote, "filling of the 400 jobs considered essential for the control of the bureaucracy," unquote. In other words, my friends, Reagan aides were saying that the bureaucracy would still be beyond their control as of today. And one more very significant quote. "To the Reagan transition staff, the current process of filling the hundreds of jobs below the level of cabinet officer is perhaps more important than the filling of the cabinet positions. The lower level aides," they said, "will be the ones actually carrying out Mr. Reagan's policies," unquote. My friends, the power struggle for control of the United States government is continuing. I outlined that struggle in AUDIO LETTER 59 last October, and in AUDIO LETTER 60 I explained how the election surprise came about. But as I mentioned then, that was only a mild setback for the Bolsheviks entrenched in powerful positions here in Washington. The real problem which is confronting the alleged Reagan forces is not in the news. It is a Supreme Court decision which was quietly engineered by the Bolsheviks here on March 31, 1980. For the lawyers among my audience, the case is that of Bronte versus Finkel. The citation is 445 U.S. 507, 1980. The case itself was unspectacular at first glance. A newly appointed public defender in New York County tried to dismiss two assistants who were leftovers or holdovers from the other political party, but the assistants filed suit to keep their jobs. The Supreme Court upheld them in the Bronte decision last March, and in the process the Court made new law by declaring that the same principle applies at all government levels, including federal. That general principle is that governmental employees cannot be dismissed simply because of their political affiliation. The ramifications of this decision are stunning, my friends. They were spelled out very well in the dissenting opinions under the names of Justices Powell, Rehnquist, and Stewart. The dissenting opinions are many pages long and naturally are filled with numerous detailed citations and arguments. But let me read a few quotations to you which speak for themselves. Quote, "The Court today continues the evisceration of patronage practices," unquote. And quote, "With scarcely a glance at almost 200 years of American political tradition, the Court further limits the relevance of political affiliation to the selection and retention of public employees. Many public positions previously filled on the basis of membership in national parties now must be staffed in accordance with a constitutionalized civil service standard that will affect the employment practices of federal, state, and local governments," unquote. And quote, "Today's decision is an exercise of judicial lawmaking," unquote. My friends, almost since the founding of our Republic, America's political system has depended upon patronage. Without patronage, your vote means nothing at all. This fact is brought out in the dissenting opinion of the Supreme Court itself in the words, quote, "Elected officials depend upon appointees who hold similar views to carry out their policies and administer their programs. Patronage, the right to select key personnel and to reward the party faithful, serves the public interest by facilitating the implementation of policies endorsed by the electorate." Unquote. Thanks to the Supreme Court Bronte decision, the new administration is having to take office with a bureaucracy that is beyond its control. The Bolsheviks entrenched in key positions nationwide at all levels of government are immune to wholesale firing. Instead, they have to be pried loose one by one based on non-political arguments. Likewise, new appointees cannot be brought in just because they are Republicans. The result is a quagmire, a government out of control. The corporate socialists have for the moment succeeded in seizing the White House under the banner of Ronald Reagan, but it is still the Bolsheviks who control the government. One result will be the opposite of the plans we are hearing for a hiring freeze. There will actually be duplicate hiring under various disguises in order to get around the entrenched Bolsheviks. That will lead to a mushrooming, inefficient government and more government spending, more bureaucracy, not less. And so, thanks to the little-known Bronte decision of the Supreme Court, the Bolsheviks here still have a stranglehold on the United States government. The new administration will try everything to whittle away at their power, but the Bolsheviks have no intention of letting themselves be whittled very far. Before that can happen, they plan to cut short the new administration under the name of Ronald Reagan. Topic number 2. For nearly 6 months now, many of you have been joining me in a preventive war of truth. Ours is a war to turn aside the plans for economic collapse, dictatorship, and thermonuclear war. To do that, we are seizing the chief weapon of our enemies and turning it against them. That weapon is the gold weapon. Those who have cornered our gold and our money are using it to destroy our way of life. But their giant gold weapon is also their Achilles heel, because they have broken laws and they have made mistakes. They have left a trail. You and I are following that trail to track them down. And if we will keep at it and not lose heart, I firmly believe that we are going to win. As you know, we began our action campaign last summer with Senator William Proxmire. At that time, he was chairman of the powerful Senate Banking Committee. He will no longer be chairman in the new Congress because of the change from Democrat to Republican control of the Senate. But Proxmire will remain on the committee, and he will continue to exercise a great deal of power. So I want to bring you up to date on our efforts with him. If you will recall, there were basically two things which we were asking of Senator Proxmire. Our main request was that he launch a public, honest investigation into the true status of America's alleged gold supplies. We specifically asked him not to just accept the self-serving words of the Treasury Department. The time is long overdue for proof, not words. So we wanted Senator Proxmire to press for an impartial, independent, complete physical inventory. Either America's gold is there or it is not there. So I urged you to challenge Senator Proxmire to prove Dr. Beter wrong. But we did not expect Senator Proxmire to do all that out of a clear blue sky. Any investigation as large as that must have a starting point. And so as a preliminary step, we gave him that starting point. We asked him to look into one very specific matter first. That was the matter of the missing gold shipment from Fort Knox of January 20, 1965, the very day Lyndon Johnson was inaugurated. Any truthful independent inquiry about that one shipment alone would raise questions that are far broader in scope, and those questions would have led into the complete investigation we are asking for. But what has the champion of the Golden Fleece Award done up to now? First, consider the matter of the missing gold shipment, which I discussed in AUDIO LETTER 56. Proxmire has yet to launch an independent investigation of any kind. Instead, he started off by doing what we asked him not to do. He asked for a report by the Treasury's own Inspector General. Then he wasted months of precious time in sending computerized brush-off letters in reply to your letters. Following standard procedure in Washington today, he gave you nothing but lip service. He kept promising you that as soon as he received the Treasury report, he would decide what to do next. My friends, even when Proxmire did receive the worthless Treasury report, he just sat on it. He was hoping that he could stall you until you lost interest and went away. Proxmire never made the promised report available until you insisted that he do so around early December. The report of the Treasury's Inspector General carries a hand-stamped date of September 30, 1980. It adds nothing new about the missing shipment. Instead, it just expands on a 5-year-old letter of Mrs. Mary Brooks, then Director of the United States Mint. I first made that letter public in AUDIO LETTER No. 2 for July 1975. The Brooks letter of 1975 served only to multiply the questions about the missing Fort Knox gold shipment, and the 1980 report by the Treasury's Inspector General only muddied the waters still further. No wonder Senator Proxmire tried to sit on the report for 2 months, because it is an unsatisfactory report. As such, it calls for Proxmire to do his duty to dig deeper, and digging deeper is the one thing Proxmire seems determined not to do. The missing gold shipment of January 20, 1965 is only one thread in the giant web of scandal surrounding our missing gold, and Proxmire has stubbornly refused even to take a glance at the giant scandal as a whole. To show you what I mean, let me remind you of a letter to Proxmire which I quoted in AUDIO LETTER No. 59 last October. It was written by an acquaintance of Proxmire in Proxmire's home state of Wisconsin. As an astute businessman, he asked Proxmire some very penetrating questions. This man has kept my good friend Mr. Edward Durrell informed about his correspondence with Proxmire. As a result, I can give you the sequel to what I reported to you in October. It is very revealing. To begin with, Proxmire never answered the letter from his friend which I read to you. After a few weeks, Proxmire's friend wrote again. He made it abundantly clear that he expected an answer Proxmire did. Proxmire's letter, dated December 3, 1980, begins with the words, quote, "I have no record of having received your earlier letter concerning a physical inventory of the nation's gold reserves. I have received a great deal of mail regarding this issue, so I do apologize for the oversight." Unquote. By the way, some of you have asked me how many people are joining in our campaign. So now you have Proxmire's own words, not just mine, that you have a lot of company. You are making yourself heard. But Proxmire spends the rest of the letter giving nothing but excuses for refusing to do his duty. It is little more than a rehash of things you have already heard, including factual errors. The letter was so bad that his friend wrote again and picked it apart almost line by line. But for you and me, there's no point in wasting any more time on Proxmire right now. My friends, we gave Senator Proxmire the benefit of the doubt. He has responded by forfeiting the opportunity to take the lead which could have been his. Under British common law, he would be considered a traitor. So for now, we will just go away and leave him alone. But Proxmire will remain a powerful member of the Senate Banking Committee. We may have occasion to deal with him again, but if we do, my friends, it will be on very different terms. Topic number 3. Just after Christmas last month, a big article about Fort Knox began appearing in newspapers nationwide. Alert listeners all over the United States have sent me copies. The publicity counterattack against our preventive war of truth has now begun. The article had 3 basic points to get across. 2 of these were familiar from countless gold propaganda in the past. One of these old familiar points was a rehash of the old myth about the impregnability of Fort Knox. The officer in charge of the bullion depository, George B. Wright, was photographed at attention outside the locked gates. And there were quotes from him like, "This is the most secure facility you will find anywhere. We are continually improving our security system," and "We have tanks and personnel carriers standing by." A second familiar point of the long article was the standard personal attack on me. My 1974 charges about our missing gold are mentioned, but those are dismissed with a yawn as, quote, "Beater's far-fetched claim," unquote. But the third propaganda trick in the article was new. In AUDIO LETTER 60 4 weeks earlier, I had reported, quote, "Watch for the non-existent gold reserves to be revalued at current market prices. In terms of dollars, our fictitious gold reserves will suddenly look 15 or 20 times bigger," unquote. The Fort Knox newspaper article started the ball rolling. It never mentioned the old official gold price of $42.22 per ounce, which is reflected in Treasury balance sheets. Instead, it hammers away at the great increase in market prices of gold. And so our psychological conditioning has now begun. We are being mentally set up for the gold revaluation publicity stunt to come. In AUDIO LETTER 59, I discussed the way in which America's gold reserves are listed on Treasury and Federal Reserve balance sheets. I did that in order to call your attention to a little-known but crucial fact. Our gold is often referred to loosely in the press as the Treasury's gold or the government's gold, but that is not correct. The gold actually belongs to the Federal Reserve System. The Treasury only serves as a physical custodian for the Federal Reserve gold, and the Treasury and the Federal Reserve balance sheets confirm that this is the situation. If this sounds like a strange arrangement, you're right. It is. But it was set up that way for a reason. Treasury custody of Federal Reserve gold created a situation of mixed responsibility, and it enabled those lines of responsibility to be blurred wherever convenient. This made it easier for those who stole our gold to hide what they had done. Even so, they have broken laws, and they have left a trail. The legal evidence is mounting that points to the Treasury Department and the Federal Reserve Board of Governors here in Washington as co-conspirators. The legal principle involved is that of a pledge misapplied in a wrongful and fraudulent manner. And, my friends, you and I are not the only victims. By and large, the presidents and directors of the regional Federal Reserve banks have also been victimized. They have been placed in positions of enormous liability by the actions of the Board here in Washington, and the evidence so far indicates that they do not realize what has been done to them. What I want to do now is to outline the legal case that is taking shape. Laws have been broken, and some very powerful men are destined for prison. I know that I have many lawyers among my listeners, and it is as a lawyer that I speak to you now. but I will also try to make my comments as clear as possible for everyone. We are being forced to try our case first in the court of public opinion, and I will conclude this topic with a new suggestion for action for you and for the regional Federal Reserve banks. On December 3, 1974, then-Secretary of the Treasury William Simon testified before a subcommittee of the House Banking Committee. The congressmen were asking about various details of the Treasury's announced plans to start holding gold auctions. The auctions were to begin a few weeks later in January 1975. In the course of the questioning, then-Congressman John Conlon in Arizona asked, "Is the government gold owned by the Federal Reserve, or is it owned by the Treasury, but the Federal Reserve has a mortgage-like interest on that gold?" Simon's answer included the words, and I quote, "It is sort of a pledge," unquote. When Simon said those two words, "sort of," quote unquote, he almost let the cat out of the bag. Fortunately for him, Simon's slip of the tongue went unnoticed at the time, and government witnesses before Congress always have a special privilege. It goes under the euphemism correcting for the record. That is, a government witness can revise his oral testimony before it is printed by the government printing office. So the officially published version of Simon's testimony was sanitized in several places. Among other things, it omits those two incriminating words, "sort of," which Simon said. According to the officially published version, Simon said to Congressman Conlon, quote, "Legally, I want to check with my attorney. Yes, it is the same. I thought it was. It is a pledge," unquote. Later in the same testimony, Conlon asked Simon how the decision is taken to sell gold. In his replies, Simon said he took the decision to the President, but he also claimed, quote, "I have the authority to do that," unquote. Now, my friends, please notice something very important. The then-Secretary of the Treasury, William Simon, was questioned about sales of Federal Reserve gold, and yet he never once made any mention of obtaining Federal Reserve permission to do so. Instead, he asserted that the Treasury itself can sell the gold without asking anyone else, not even the President. The only legal basis held out for this is the claim that the gold is a pledge. My friends, please bear with me now. There is an essential legal point here which has to be made. Those who need to know about it most urgently are the officers and directors of the regional Federal Reserve banks, but I will need your help to bring this about. As I am about to explain, the wool has been pulled over their eyes as well as ours.